All right. Andy's grabbing some water now. I've got my sippy thing that I got during my stroke, which my lovely wife got me to make sure I drink a lot of water. That's it, like, great. Tells you good job through the course of drinking it down.
Yeah, your wife is lovely, and she's I like to hear her talk about your matrimonial happiness.
Nice. She is lovely. She's lovely, and she's great. She's writing an article right now about that Sinners movie. I don't know if you saw that one.
Yeah, I did. And I liked it a lot, actually.
I liked it, too.
I would have, you know, that's another of many things that I wish I could talk with Joshua about, because, you know, it's kind of right up his alley. I don't know if we saw Fruitvale Station together, but I certainly talked about pretty much every Ryan Coogler film with Joshua.
I was impressed. I thought it was a very good movie, and I think that she there's different ways to come at it, and she's like spends a lot of time at Jalopy, and she's like kind of like a folk music person. So
I see
the different folk way, the blues and the Irish folk stuff, like kind of jogged something for her about the American experience. So
yeah,
that's a good movie.
Yeah, the one scene, you know. The kind of 360 degree tracking scene where he sings. I forget the character's name, but
Sammy.
Yeah. And that could have been done so poorly.
It really
worked, and it, you know, had everything to do with the sound mix.
And it's, you're right. It could have been really bad. And I think it's going to go down in history as one of those scenes, you know, that's just like extremely well done. Iconic. Even. All right, let's start potting. Let's do it.
All right, let's do it.
Let's do it.
All right, thanks for joining us, Jasper. You're in CIA New Left headquarters in Topeka Canyon. Maybe I shouldn't say that.
True. Yeah, that's
right. You're by the Naval Intelligence Station.
It doubles as an ayahuasca retreat, like pretty much everything else up here.
Nice. So, yeah.
Usually the CIA uses LSD for its projects, but maybe they moved on to ayahuasca.
They've moved on to ayahuasca.
They've gone Make America Healthy Again. They find ayahuasca to be a more organic treatment, you know?
It's true.
MK Under plus guidance. Ultra. So we're going to talk about your new book today, The Future of Revolution, but maybe we just talk a little bit about our May Days first.
Yeah.
Sean and I had a pretty low-key May Day. We went to the ILC chili cook-off at Woodbine. I had the vegan chilies, including Z's prize-winning Chipotle Beyond Z's Chili. That was the highlight for
Z's
me.
Was a great chili.
I did not try Sean's chili because it was filled with dead animals.
It was, but I managed to win the best spices.
And you won a bottle of poppers. That was the best prize.
Impressive.
I did win a bottle of poppers. I didn't win that weird book about Yetis or something like that. I also got a ribbon too, which I felt really good about. I hope that there wasn't like nepotism involved there at that ILC event. Like they let me win or whatever. But I used one of Rax's tricks, and you know, she's like a half an authentic Spanish person. You get the dried chilies and you make like an adobo mix out of that stuff.
That's nice.
So nice.
I think that's what did it. That's what brought me over the line. But next year, I think I'm going to do a Beyond Meat thing. I'm going to do like a vegan thing just so Andy can try it and love it and talk about it on camera.
Yeah, my goal is to pressure everyone to make all their food vegan when there's even a chance that I might show up.
Well, listen, next year, maybe do a little less marching and a little more cooking.
I could not have done less marching. I would have to be walking backwards and get negative miles. But how was your May Day, Jasper?
Entirely uneventful. I spent it in the car. I was just driving down here to LA so I could do this book event in UC Irvine on the 2nd.
So you took the day off from revolutionary activity on May Day to drive.
I took the day off, yeah, and I actually even taught in the morning, as disrespectful as that is, because yeah, I'd already missed a lot of classes this semester and wanted to get my students ready for
fair everything. Enough. I heard the I don't know what it was like out on the West Coast, but I heard on the East Coast that there were actually a lot of people at the May Day marches here in New York. There was large contingents of traditional trade unions, which I was asking somebody about and asking my friend Dave about, and he said he suspects it's because May Day landed closer to like Trump's inauguration and all the Doge cuts than Labor Day would have. So the trade unions are trying to like put up some sort of resistance, including apparently federal, like Ask Me trade unions were out there marching on May Day too, which I found interesting. And he thought that it was just because he didn't think there was anything like revolutionary, like American trade unions are attaching themselves to May Day against like the scab American Labor Day. He thought it was more tactical in that if you're going to put up like resistance to Trump as a big trade union these days, this is just a little bit closer to the action that Labor Day would be later this year.
That makes sense. Yeah, I usually don't expect much from May Day, but it seems like there was a lot more interest in making it something this year.
It does.
You know, sometimes I just feel May Day can be a kind of ritualistic and therefore somewhat meaningless.
Well, back in
day
the
of action,
I remember back in the EndNotes decade, which we'll get into later, there would be these compilations of all the riots around the world. And maybe that's someone true made it this year and just wasn't on my radar. But yeah, it seems like that enthusiasm for May Day at least has sort of died down, which, you know, from a New York perspective, it kind of makes sense because, like, I used to always go to the main May Day march just because I thought, like ritualistically. And it was just always so terrible that it got to the point where I was just sort of going and making fun of it. And at some point, someone like kind of said, "Hey, why are you even here?" And I was like, "You know what? Good point. I'm just not going to come to this anymore."
Yeah,
that's what I did this year. And it's interesting. This is a dynamic that maybe we could tease out later on in the episode or in a bonus or something. But one thing that I noticed is that over the last 10, 15 years or so, and I think especially in the last 5 years or so, the start of May Day festivities have moved from Union Square down to Foley Square. Like, it always used to be all the marches would jump off from Union Square, and then they'd hit Washington Square, then maybe they make it down to Foley Square and the Civic Center. But now it's like the main event is like going down to where all the courts are.
Yeah, yeah.
And you like start your march there, which I think is interesting. Maybe that typifies the fact that the EndNotes decade is over and now we're in a more like political, quasi-political moment, a more like confrontational moment. I don't know what it is. We could talk about it later.
Probably less confrontational.
We're definitely in a different moment, but it remains to be seen what is different.
What is different? Well, I mean, you're here partially for that, right, Andy? I mean, we're bringing you to the table here. You've got a new book out, The Future of Revolution, Communist Perspectives from the Paris Commune to the George Floyd Uprising by you, Jasper Burns, out from Verso. It's out now, right? Like, people can buy it now?
I think you can buy it now. It's technically not released until May 13th. It was supposed to be released on April 26th, but there was a delay at the printer because someone waged a ransomware attack on the printer and caused millions of dollars of damage.
Wow.
Direct proletarian action. Perhaps they were rising up against their paymasters at Verso and they wanted to get in there and smash up the machines. Day Luddites. You know, like, as time goes on, you know the famous story, the feeding of the 3,000? When Crass puts this record out, the feeding of the 5,000, it's famously like a very sacrilegious record. And so the printers of the vinyl refused to print it. Like, they went on strike and refused to release this Crass Records record. I had a pet theory recently I was thinking about on my way home from work, where when you're young, you think like, oh, these terrible printers and their censorship of this great Crass sacrilegious music. But then you like grow up and maybe you're in a trade union, you're like, you know what, workers control of production, maybe they were right. Maybe they were right to shut the print. Anyways, I'm like way off in left field now. Let's talk about
Crass. Is not as revolutionary left as people make. They've, you know, they've got some good lyrics and some bad lyrics, but that's not what we're here to talk about.
That's not what we're here to talk about.
I do want to start talking about the book with a question about sort of our moment and like the audience for the book. But before we get to that, we of course said goodbye to our friend Joshua Clover on last week's episode, and Jasper was a very close friend of Joshua and a close collaborator for many years. That's how I know him. So I just want to ask if you have anything to say about Joshua or maybe his relevance to this book.
Well, Joshua and I shared a vocabulary and a set of themes and concepts that is inseparable from this book. I think that we both hit on this idea at the same time, and I don't know, you know, who it came from, actually, that circulation was an important area of struggle, and that struggle had in some ways moved from the arena of production to the arena of circulation, and that what we see in the most recent cycle of struggles, and arguably since the 1970s, is the rise of what he calls circulation struggles. And that's a formulation that's very similar to what I say in my article and endnotes, Logistics, Counter-Logistics, and the Communist Prospect.
Which we did have you on about, so if people are interested, they can go back in the archive and listen to that episode as well. But sorry, go on.
So you know, and I continue with that analysis in this book. And what I say is that since 1968, we see struggles that are, as I say, eccentric to production. That's not to say that they don't involve production, but they have a kind of other site that is outside of the workplace. And so I say, you know, it's as if in the early 20th century, during the height of the workers' movement, the mass strike or mass struggle was a circle, with its center in the workplace. Now it's more of an ellipse, and it has two foci. One is in the workplace, but the other is kind of outside it. And that's why you see struggles today often intervene in the sphere of circulation. But nonetheless, the communist prospect, socialization of wealth, and the creation of a classless, moneyless, stateless society will still require us to take over production, but we may need to do it in a different way than people conceived of that project in the early 20th century, and that sort of changes what kinds of organizations might emerge to produce communism.
So I read this book way back in January, February 2025 when I first got it, and it was
podcaster's privilege.
Yeah, very bleak times, you know, it was cold outside. Trump had come in and he was rolling out all of his bullshit, and no one really had any good ideas about what to do about it, you know, across the entire political spectrum. And, you know, I was listening to a lot of Bob Dylan because of the Timothée Chalamet movie, and, you know, feeling very nostalgic for the optimism of these revolutionary moments that you stitch together throughout the book. Some of them happened long before I was born, some of them just a few years ago, and generally thinking that this is a very good book for this kind of between struggle headspace to sort of reflect on the entirety of history and recognize that it's ongoing. And I was wondering what you had in mind in terms of who your audience was going to be, at least initially when it comes out, and what you wanted them to take away from it.
Well, you know, I write, I think, for myself and strangers, as Gertrude Stein once said. So in some way, you never really know who your audience is, and you know, there's some hope that an unintended audience might emerge. But I write the book for anyone who thinks of themselves as a communist and a revolutionary and who wants to know what communist revolution might look like. I'm certainly interested in speaking to other readers who aren't necessarily communists or necessarily revolutionaries, but I don't think that the book you know, really speak to that vision and whatever concerns those people might have. So it's, I think that there are a lot of people who think of themselves as communists and revolutionaries, but who by their own mission feel like they don't really know what that would look like or how it would unfold. And that's an understandable starting point because it's, you know, it's difficult to imagine and no revolution has succeeded. And there's also a kind of idea that maybe we shouldn't or can't talk about it, that we just have to kind of leave it to the future to figure it out and decide. And there's some truth to that. There's a lot that we can't figure out now that will have to be figured out within the revolution. But nonetheless, there's still some things that we can say about the prospect of communist revolution.
I read this book much more recently, which is to say the last several days. So I've been, I guess, unlike Andy, I've been fortunate enough to, I don't know, get out of those doldrums, which last winter represented. And maybe last year when you wrote it also felt like a bleak period. Feels like we've had a lot of bleak periods. The book itself read, it really like brought me back to a lot of debates and readings that I've done, we've done, this podcast has done, I've done independently over the last 10 or 15 years or so. Maybe questions that I've had in the back of my mind and preoccupations that I feel like, at least for now, I've kind of dealt with. So it was really good in this transitionary way that Andy talks about it, because we're all still dealing with the same question, the question posed after 68, the question posed by the ultra left, the question posed by communization theory, which is like wither the communist movement after the death of the classical workers movement, you know? And your book is like, I think really, really powerful and a good way to pick up that question again from an optimistic perspective. Cause if anything, you know, if I've left these questions behind, it's partially because I have left some of the optimism behind, the optimism of the idea of a cycle of struggles, the optimism that maybe like C.L.R. James had, as you point out in your book, that like the workers, that the working class had kind of figured things out. And it just had to be sort of like, they had to come to the self-realization that they themselves were in this revolutionary process. He's writing this in like the late 40s. So I found it to be a really, really good book in like resetting these questions again in front of us in a period where they seem so far away, but they should be at the front of our mind. So I don't know. Is it wrong that I lost faith in history? Like, is this book meant to bring me back? Because you kind of helped do that a little bit.
It's not wrong. It's understandable. This has been a dark period, especially the last 5 years since the 2020 George Floyd uprising. So I understand that perspective, and I know many people who've become extraordinarily pessimistic in the last 5 years. But I think if we take a step back and we look at things from a kind of more abstract perspective, there's still plenty of hope because there's a lot of doom, and capitalism has enormous problems that we are starting to see emerge right now. And we've just seen the beginning of the process of climate change, which is going to upend everything. And so, you know, I think we really just don't know what's going to happen. You know, not just to say in 10 years from now, but also next year or this year.
Yeah, so the book sort of begins with the Paris Commune and goes through, you know, a sort of narrative of revolutionary history through councilism, left communism, and the new left revolutionary tradition up through the end notes decade, as we like to call it. And through this span, there's this ongoing principle that you call the test of communism. What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, the test of communism is a way of reading Marx, essentially. And it's a way of understanding the usefulness of Marx's theory of value, which is on one hand, it's a description of capitalism, but it is also a kind of negative description of communism. That's to say, value, in as much as it defines specifically what capitalism is, also defines what needs to be abolished. But the abolition of value doesn't in and of itself produce communism. There's a kind of remainder. So beyond the test of value, there's a kind of positive dimension of the communist project that needs to be articulated. And I describe that as the test of communism. And essentially, it's a test of whether society is organized in free associations that are consciously controlling the means of production in order to produce for need, and doing so with a common plan for common production for common use. And you know, Marx specifies exactly, not exactly, but quite specifically how he sees this unfolding, particularly in his writings on the Paris Commune, which he calls the form at last discovered in which to work out the economic emancipation of man. And that's a pretty grand statement. It means that there's something about the Paris Commune that will be retained in future revolutions. And he turns out to be right, because when the Workers' Councils emerge in 1905 and later in 1917 and 1918, they more or less follow precisely this form that he described in his writing on the Paris Commune. And they add to it some additional specifications and restrictions, which address some of the problems with the communal form. So, you know, essentially, I think we can look at past revolutions and learn from them not what to do exactly or the particular program that we can follow, but we can learn from them what the logical contours of a kind of revolutionary horizon are and the conditions which a revolution must fulfill. And that's going to be true of whatever organizations emerge in the future in 21st century revolutions, whether we call them councils or communes or whatever. They will still need to fulfill these conditions and these functions.
So you say early on in the book that you know, and I didn't quite feel attacked, but I felt like seen here, that some people out there think that we need to relive, you know, the 19th and the 20th century. Like we need to go back to ground zero. But you're like, no, we've learned the lessons. We've learned the lessons that needed to be learned. What do we and what does your book pose for the listeners out there who haven't yet had a chance to read your book? What does your book pose in terms of like what institutional forms will be learning these lessons? Maybe the distinction between the communists, the movement of communists versus like the proletarian movement. Who's learning lessons and how are they being expressed?
Well, I think revolutionaries learn lessons and when they participate in revolutions. I think in the cycle of struggles in our time, which didn't get as far as past revolutions, there were nonetheless lessons learned. I think the lessons were largely about the importance of annulling state power and the armed power of the state. In Egypt, right, the Egyptian revolution was stalled precisely because it didn't attempt to oppose the army, and in fact identified the revolution with the army. And this wasn't, you know, this wasn't universal, but there were enough people who identified with the army that it essentially, you know, foreclosed any emancipatory horizon for that revolution. And so, you know, that's I think the first lesson of past revolutions is that you need to abolish the armed power of the state. Marx says this very explicitly, and it's something that I think he learned from the experience of 1848. And it's, you know, it's simply true of every revolution that we can look at. And we can almost define a revolution as something that unfolds to the degree to which the armed power of the state has been suspended. And this is a process that happens by degrees. It doesn't occur all at once. Even in the German Revolution, which I describe at great length, which, you know, ended World War I and the German Empire through this kind of mass mutiny, it didn't completely end the armed power of the state. which was, you know, the state was reconstituting its power, even as these, you know, soldiers' councils were taking over military barracks.
Yeah, that was, I think, for, you know, in terms of the history of the book, that's I learned a lot from that. Your narrative of that I had not really heard before in that detail. So I really recommend people, if they want to learn more about the German Revolution, check out that chapter. Another point, you know, going back to the question of councils, is you make this point early on in the intro that all of the forms of struggle that we sort of talk about kind of happened in the 19th century, except for the council, which begins not too long after the 19th century in 1905. And so the council becomes sort of this central concept of like the form of how communism will be built. And that kind of maintains itself through the left communists and the council communists until more or less the post-war period, the emergence of the new left. And then these same councilists who you've been tracking begin to critique the council and, you know, connect it to this sudden lack of interest in workers in continuing to identify themselves as workers, or maybe to have the ambition of taking over the economy or taking over their factories or like running the economy themselves. There's now this sort of generalized refusal of work. And I think this is so, you know, that people love to reject the new left and say this is infantile or, you know, this is the problem. But this is, in my experience as a worker, you know, in the particular jobs I've done, this is true. People don't identify themselves as working at the place that they work, or as, you know, that's not their subjectivity. And so I think that's why we see Jasper's outside. So we're hearing some air traffic above him.
Yeah. Helicopter.
All right.
Yeah.
Hope everyone's all right.
So yeah, how do you integrate this critique of councilism into this narrative? And like, what does it mean that this one form that we've invented in the last century has maybe lost its mystique?
Well, I think it really depends on what you mean by the council. Certainly, we have to take into account what I call the refusal of labor and the kind of disidentification with the labor process, and also the fact that labor has been transformed in such a way that it makes it really hard for workers to identify with what they do. I mean, there are some workers who do kind of identify with their workplaces, but those tend to be particular kinds of workplaces. And so we need to kind of imagine a communist horizon that takes that into account, and that people can't really, see themselves in their work, largely because they don't understand what it is that they're doing in relationship to the larger society and how it's socially necessary and useful. A lot of us do things for work that simply wouldn't exist in a communist society. And there's more and more people doing that kind of work. One thing you notice in late capitalism is the growth of what we call unproductive labor. And there's many kinds of unproductive labor, but a big category of unproductive labor is labor that has to do with reproducing the commodity form, right? Banking, cashiering, advertising, all kinds of things like that. And there's more and more of that labor necessary. And there simply wouldn't be any need for that kind of work in a communist society. So it's not surprising that people, therefore, disidentify with that kind of work. If you're making shoes, it's really easy to see how what you're doing is socially useful.
It's interesting if we think about, because I've thought a lot about this recently, about the production process and this. I think what you're talking about, this disaggregation of the labor process across space, the de-skilling of many different labor processes, work becoming more and more burdensome and boring, right? Especially yep. in a factory setting. If you juxtapose that to like, say, what I do for a living, where you don't have a one boring job site you go to, maybe you go to six or seven of them every single year. And sometimes you get to see an entire building or piece of infrastructure come together from like scratch, from like an empty lot to like a skyscraper. You know, there's a way in which some workers live in the 21st century where work is just like a zone, or like production is just like post-production, or it's like moving commodities or pieces of paper around or whatever. But then other people like myself and the people I work with live in like the 19th century,
right,
where like capital is still this like feels as though it's experienced as a productive process that like human beings actually have control over, right? So yeah. I wonder if like, because there's always this tension within communist theory of like the destructive versus the creative, I feel like we're very comfortable pointing at and recognizing the 21st century production process, this disaggregated international supply chain. Everyone's just kind of a cog in this larger wheel, right? But there still does exist this sort of substratum of production that takes place, not just in New York City, but all over the country and the world, that still has like a 19th century, almost artisanal character to it and a creative character to it, too. And I wonder what like the place of that that older sort of productive process, what place there might be for that in the movement towards communism. This is something that obviously like I think about a lot, because it's like, what is my place? What is our place in this process? And I wonder if like it's not these two things in opposition to one another, but perhaps their synthesis, like an older sort of creative potential combining with a sort of like newer negative potential of the proletariat in the 21st century that might provide some breakthroughs. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's well put. Certainly construction workers are going to be necessary in communism. We're going to have to build things. We're going to have to build lots of housing. If you think about the kinds of migration that we're going to see over the next 50 to 100 years, it's going to require a lot of building and rebuilding. And then we have to redesign housing for climate change and for reduced energy use, right? So we need to kind of design buildings that passively heat and cool. And we need to refurbish houses that to make them, you know, habitable. And that's going to be something that we're going to want to involve construction workers in, so they can kind of generalize and share their skills. But I think right. in a revolutionary process, it might kind of tend to break down the boundaries between construction workers and other kinds of workers as, you know, more people are brought in. One of the things that you see with this layer of productive workers that do identify with their work is that they're comparatively better paid.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, that's an issue, right? Because you get a kind of older sort of guild or trade sensibility that comes with that privilege. And you know, and a kind of a sense of ownership over the work process itself.
Right. Like
with that yeah. sense of meaning also comes this kind of notion of ownership, which is that this is our place, and it's
these
for
are
us.
these are our skills. This is right. our organization. It's not part of a broader class fight. It's more. You're right. Exactly. I think that we've seen over the last 150 years since these organizations arose, like the petty bourgeoisification of what was in the 19th century like a socialist trade struggle has turned right. into now like a more petty bourgeois ownership of these skills. And I wonder like maybe what the 20th century is going to do to that, and how we can maybe keep some of the kernels of like process and skill and ownership or whatever, not throw that baby out with the bathwater as, you know, capital comes for some of these final bastions of like workers' control, you know. But this is taking us maybe a little far afield. Andy, did you have another question?
Yeah, I mean, well, continuing with that, like, you know, the book is about the future of revolution. And so does revolution, does it mean something different now than it did before? Are we still basically trying to answer the same questions as Marx after the Paris Commune? Or does this eccentricity that you describe in the post-war period mean that revolution is somehow different? Like, is it no longer really about bringing the working class to power, like the dictatorship of the proletariat, as Marx also described the Paris Commune? I mean, you've got an interesting image of it towards the end of the book with these abolitionist councils, but is this something sort of qualitatively different than the Soviets, for example?
Well, I think it both is and isn't different. I think that it's that what I'm imagining and what I think is going to be necessary is close enough to the councils and the commune that we can say in some senses that it will need to be the same, in the sense that it will need to fulfill the same functions that the communes and the workers' councils projected for themselves. At the same time, many things about capital and about labor have changed, which means that the starting point is different. So I think in some ways the horizon and the project of communism hasn't really changed that much. But the starting point and the means may be a little different. And so, you know, one thing I think that essentially we're going to need organizations that are, as I say, inclusive, that include the vast majority of humanity, right? Which is one way to define the proletariat. The proletariat is a vast majority. And that means that that the proletariat cannot come to power as a class ruling over another class, because you can't have majority rule. That doesn't make any sense, right? Rule is always the rule of a particular minority. And so the only thing that the proletariat can do is to either become another kind of ruling class, and then they would no longer be proletarians, but to abolish themselves and all classes. So that fact that it needs to be inclusive still remains. Also, another thing that we can derive logically from the necessity of revolution is that the revolution will need to be inclusive, but it will also need to provide means for people to coordinate their action and to kind of plan and produce in common for common use. And that doesn't mean that everything needs to be deliberated over or calculated, but there does need to be some sense of kind of unitary construction. So you're going to need some process of delegation, because you simply can't have the vast majority in one building. We can't cram all, you know, 5 billion people in some area or some, you know, zone into one building. So those things remain true. And so we're going to need organizations that meet those conditions. And I think those will look like councils to some degree. But in other ways, they probably will differ from the workers' councils. I think that the main difference is that we can no longer imagine those councils being centered on the workplace. The German workers' councils, they had a way of making sure that participants were proletarians, and they essentially asked people for work history. You didn't have to be a worker at that particular factory to join the council, but you had to show some work history.
Had to show your fingers.
I mean, there were very different conditions for inclusion in many places. That condition wasn't even followed, and they let all kinds of people in who weren't workers. I mean, you know, Max Weber joined his his council, his local council. So
good SPD member.
You don't want Max Weber in your council. But
you do, and I want to bring this up while we're on it. You mentioned Bordiga, right? Had a definition of where he wanted to move away from exploitation and instead look at the proletariat in terms of dispossession, right?
That's right.
So talk a little bit about that. That's in your book.
Right. So I think that we're going to need to have a kind of different notion of how we ensure the proletarian character of this revolutionary project. It's not going to suffice to ask for work history, because a lot of proletarians don't have work history. And so there's going to need to be some other mechanism to determine that it's proletarian.
It's AI, obviously. Like, yeah, you need the workers' council have to choose between Grok or ChatGPT or whatever. Maybe the Doge team can go through with a wrecking ball and figure out people's work history and whether or not they qualify as proletarians. What do you think, Andy? Get the Doge, get big balls on it.
Well, you know, if we try to stick with this thought experiment of the abolitionist council, like if the George Floyd uprising pushed towards a revolution and it established these abolitionist councils that Jasper speculates about, where the question of abolition transitions from this kind of place where it was left during the uprising, where it was like, do we abolish the police, or do we, you know, cut their funding and put it towards something else? And it, you actually had people committed to this task and thinking about what abolition means. They could potentially come to this concept of, well, it actually, abolishing the police is actually not going to do anything. We have to abolish class society. We have to abolish capitalism. And so then that, that political question of abolition kind of moves the struggle into a more revolutionary direction. And then, so in terms of like, who's going to be in those meetings, who's going to be doing that deliberation. Yeah, it's hard for me to imagine how you would make everybody, how you'd qualify everyone as proletarian aside from them agreeing with this common task. And I think that, that there's this tension in the book around this between forms and tactics, where we think of the form as like, well, we're trying to establish, for example, the party, or, you know, a workers' council or a union or something. But is it better to think of the council as a tactic, as a way of achieving the goals of whatever particular struggle, whatever moment we're in?
I think it's better to conceive of it as a function rather than a form. And in that sense, it's a tactic, but it's not really just a tactic. It's also a strategy, because it contains within it an horizon, right? The idea is that the Workers' Council, when one forms, it's a call to form others. And it's also a call to produce communism and to overthrow the state. And so in that sense, it's both a tactic and a strategy, right? But I do think that looking at it in as a function or a process is more helpful than thinking of it just as a form. There are many critiques of the formalism of some ideas of council communism, and it's true that as a form it could be used to reconstruct class society
as it was in the German Revolution, right? I mean, like, exactly. The SPD comes to the workers' councils and they're like,
right,
vote for us for the, you know, right, your councils, and we'll give you democracy. They're like, okay, cool. And would they, right, enshrine the workers' councils in the Constitution, even in the Weimar Constitution?
That's right. They're still part of the
state
structure of Germany. Yeah.
Yeah. Socialist Germany.
Yeah.
Interesting. Andy, did you have another follow-up or no?
Yeah, I mean, we could talk more about the question of the party, because on this show and also in our Discord community, we've talked a lot about our episode with Vincent Bevins a little over a year ago, and also your critique of it in the Brooklyn Rail.
Yeah.
Vincent Bevins' book, If We Burn, and you critique this in the Brooklyn Rail. I'll put that in the show notes. I think this is a central question that leftists in general, maybe not communists, leftists in general, including communists, are asking quite a bit today, which is if nothing is possible unless we have a party or something like it. And this is also something that comes up in these three critiques or discussions of your book in this month issue of the Brooklyn Rail.
That's right.
And the finer details of these critiques aside, do you think this structure versus spontaneity or horizontality versus verticality question is a good way to think about the party question, or does this also sort of lose the sort of strategic aspect of it?
I don't think it's a great way to think about it. And I follow Endnotes here in their excellent essay, Spontaneity, Mediation, Rupture, in which they really trouble this notion of self-organization and spontaneity in a useful way. But when I talk about the party, I'm really talking about what Bordiga calls the historical party, or come on, following Bordiga. And that's not necessarily a formal organization. That's to say, there's a process of partisanization that occurs in any revolution. There are people who are committed to the survival and success of the revolution, and they're no longer acting without any kind of forethought or planning or pledge or kind of commitment to each other. And that's something that you're not going to get away from. That's just the condition of a revolution, is that there are people who are kind of passionately committed to it. And they may not be in the same organization, but we can still think of them as a party in the sense that their goal is to produce the conditions for communism. And sometimes that active minority or that collection of partisans has particular ideas about leading or educating the struggle that I think are not helpful. But there is a particular idea of the party coming out of council communism that conceives of it less as a form of leading or educating the proletariat than a mechanism for providing the conditions for the proletariat to kind of assume control over society and abolish itself. And so the party sort of vanishes in the process of producing the revolution. It's a catalyst in the sense that a catalyst can, you know, allow two other elements to combine and form something new, but there's no trace of the catalyst left in the final process, final product.
That's what I still find very compelling, the idea of the maps that you put together and the counter logistics work that you've done, which is, I think, like a very practical and meaningful project, because lost, I think, in all of the debates around the 20th century, not the high minded and good debates that you see in like the Endnotes series, or for example, but like weird debates between like Marxist Leninists and Maoists and like Pol Pot supporters and like Gonzaloites and stuff like that, is that the party wasn't meant to be a party in like a capitalist sense. One of the main functions of it was supposed to prepare the proletariat for self-governance and self-rule over society, right? And so where your counter logistics comes in, and it comes in back in this book right here, is that like by creating a map and understanding, also workers' inquiries, I think importantly, come up in your book a lot as this sort of red thread that runs through the communist movement, self-understanding of the proletariat and its condition. Like the idea that a party, maybe more nebulous than we would imagine, like a Marxist-Leninist party, is there to provide the proletariat with the opportunity for self-knowledge and self-understanding of its own role in the production process and understanding the map of capital so that it could be confronted and overcome. I mean, I'm really glad you picked that thread up again in the book. Do you have anything more to say about that here?
Well, I think that that's very well stated. I mean, that's precisely what I argue. I call this technical inquiry, but another name for it that might be better is mapping the productive forces. This is the way that this group of Finnish and Hungarian communists who are working on this idea of technical inquiry, and they've already gone much further than me, and they describe it as mapping the productive forces.
They're doing this now?
Mapping the reproductive forces. Yeah, they're doing this now.
No shit,
they're starting
to
engage in some of these projects. And, you know, and I'm also really inspired by the work that Nick Chavez has done, both on his own and with Phil Neal. I think you've had Nick on the show,
several times.
Yeah.
So, you know, his, and this comes back to your question about construction workers. Nick and I just did an event last night here in LA, and he was kind of talking about the process of, you know, how we're going to get engineers to help us with communism,
right?
And we're going to need the knowledge that these engineers have, and we're going to need them to kind of share it with everybody and simplify it so that it's kind of easier for people to participate in, you know, producing their own conditions of life. And so I think that this idea that inquiry could become the basis for certain organization, which is something I derive from not exactly the historical Council of Communism in the 1920s, but it's the Council of Communist revival after World War II. You get this new idea of workers' inquiry. And I think that that's expanded in some sense, that what we see now is a kind of field of inquiry into proletarian action that isn't just strictly kind of workers' inquiry, looking at how people struggle in the workplace and how they experience their working conditions, but also struggle inquiry. I think that's, you know, something that you are doing here in this podcast, and that, you know, projects like EndNotes or Ill Will or Chuang or the Brooklyn Rail Field Notes, they share information about proletarian struggles, which is really vital and important, right?
To kind of relay
this information.
Well, it's not, I mean, for most people who consider themselves on the left, it's like either unimportant or invisible, and they're just like not interested in it. One of the things, I'll give a short plug, a little plug to ILC, as we have a workers' inquiry group, and it's like attendant to membership of the ILC that you take a workers' inquiry upon yourself, not merely so that we can get an understanding of where people are at and their surroundings and their relationship to the production process, but also to ground people, because sometimes people like us, they need to be reminded that they too have work lives, you know, that they too are part of a production process, whether that's productive, reproductive, you know, whether it's in the service or circulation or productive sector. And that process of grounding yourself, even if you're unemployed or a student or whatever, I think is really, really important. So you pick that thread up really nicely, I feel like, in this book. Well done.
Thank you.
Yeah, and
go ahead. Sorry, Andy, go ahead. No, I was gonna throw a little fly in the ointment here, because it occurred to me as I was reading this, and I was like, towards the end of the book, I have here page 173 in my notes. You know, I'm thinking about what else is happening during the George Floyd uprising. You know, what else? What other protest movements are going on? And it's like, you're not even supposed to bring this up, but like, I remember Wildcat strikes at factories in the Midwest, largely like this remaining organized working class, largely in the military industrial complex sector, walking out against vax mandates. And I'm thinking to myself, 5 years on, are we willing to ask the question, like, what could these movements have said to each other if they had the opportunity, what might have they have said, and would there be any points of unity there? Like, being anti-police or like anti-armed agents of the states is very American. So is like saying like the government can't mandate that I put something in my body. These are both like, in a way, like civil liberty struggles, you know, the Republican struggles, right? Get the state off my back. But there was no way and no form and no means, no organization. And I think ideologically a great gulf in between these two movements, which at least theoretically we could imagine could have been in conversation with one another. What do you think about that?
I'd like to answer this one. I think the George Floyd uprising was that conversation, because there were also wildcat strikes that were against the laxity of COVID precaution in people's workplaces, because
Amazon,
million plus Americans died largely from their catching COVID before the vaccine at their workplace. Or bring it back to their places where they live, their families, their apartment buildings. So although you're correct, there was a small minority of workers who were anti-vax and against COVID regulation. I think like 5 to 10%, maybe. The George Floyd uprising, you saw sort of, in my opinion, there was a It was not only about the police, it was not only about racism, but it was also about the COVID response. It was this widespread rejection of the COVID response. And, and this, to sort of bring this back to the book, like, and the question of like the party, the question of what communists should do or how they should relate to the proletariat. Communists can sit down and read texts and like look over their workers' inquiries and such and come up with some very smart ideas and analysis and projects, but when you're talking about millions of proletarians fighting together in the streets, that's a much higher form of collective intelligence. And I think these questions were resolved, or at least attacked in a better way in the uprising than they could be in like these interminable debates about like vaccines that we're still having in this country. But it's also, there's a role for communists to understand how that's playing out in the uprising. And so people who wrote about the uprising at the time, talked to people, recorded their what they observed, what people were saying, what people were doing, connecting that between cities, between different months and phases of it. you know, EndNotes did this, SM28 did this, and, yep. you know, people in our milieu did this. This is really maybe the most important task we could do. I mean, there's other ways to, like, push those struggles forward in the streets, of course. But just seeing what's happening and trying to draw serious lessons and theories about what you've witnessed is, what did the Johnson Forest tendency call this? Like, recognize and report, something like that?
Yeah.
And that's,
I agree.
Yeah, that's I think that's the kind of conclusion of your book is, like, this is what we ought to be doing. We're transistors. We're looking for instances of working class autonomy, and we're trying to put them in conversation with one another.
That's right. That's right. And I think one thing that was interesting about the pandemic, and also partly a problem that it encountered, is that the pandemic conditions were part of what made the 2020 uprising so explosive, right? Because
right.
so many people who weren't in school or had been furloughed from work or whatever. But at the same time, the fear of catching COVID also made it hard for people to gather together indoors and discuss things. Certainly, some people had less concerns about that than others. But I think that there was an absence of this kind of discussion or deliberation in that movement. And, you know, it's not just about the pandemic. It's also about race in the United States and racialization and these kind of barriers that continue to exist, and a sort of lack of trust among different participants in the uprising. But I do think that that's what would have needed to happen. And, you know, the idea of inquiry could be useful even in that pandemic context, because there was so much misinformation.
Yeah.
Right. There was so much. I mean, it's really hard to understand something like a virus. It's complex, and, you know, there's kind of mathematics involved and biology. And then you have all of this kind of counter information out there. And so maybe, you know, a project of collective inquiry that is like looking at, you know, hey, let's really figure out who is getting sick and where, and what would be the best way to keep people safe could be useful in that kind of situation.
And yeah, the state will not be doing that anymore.
No.
Or
no.
The level they once were. No. So it's going to be imperative that people with the knowledge to, example, test sewage water for, you know, evidence of a virus.
That's right.
Are going to publish those reports somewhere. Because
I may or may not know a guy that's working on a DEP job. He might have some connections in that regard.
Yeah.
He can get us a sewage test.
I can get you sewage. I got a guy.
We're gonna have
Andy, I'll bring sewage tomorrow. Jasper, I will mail you sewage whenever you want. I will send
it
directly to your father's house. You want a test tube? You want a box truck? I will send as much sewage as you need.
Don't send it in a box truck.
All right. Whatever keeps us safe, friends.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting. Yeah, we may need a communist FDA that can go around testing for E. coli. Because certainly the state isn't going to do that.
It's a fascinating moment. Like, being brought back to 2020 means being brought back into the debates and even the information that was shared, like the difference between the information on the virus and the information about the uprising, from whether Donald Trump was president or Biden was president, the politicization of science. I mean, in retrospect, as lay people, I remember Andy and I were like struggling with this in real time. It was extremely difficult to not have like a biased outlook on things. Is it even possible to be unbiased in a situation like that? I mean, I don't know how good a job we did, but, you know, your book really opened up to me like how chaotic the last 5 years have been and how they're not getting any less chaotic. In fact, only more so. So your book only becomes more relevant, I feel like, as things get wild and woolly.
Thanks. Yeah, I think that one thing that we need to reflect on a bit more is that conspiratorialism and conspiracy thinking was not just a phenomenon on the right during the 2020 uprising. There was a, you know, a left-wing and liberal conspiratorialism, right? There's a kind of, you know,
the provocateurs,
MSNBC, you know, QAnon phenomena. And you know, I do think we live in this age of conspiracy thought, and it needs to be opposed. You know, and there's certain people that are saying, hey, we should just run with this.
Yeah, yeah. I know what people you're talking about.
We should accept that we no longer live in this era in which the truth exists or things mean anything, and we should just kind of be, I guess, Nietzschean about it and just say whatever we think will be helpful to say.
But
some Storellian action.
I remember you do talk a little bit about the sort of tension between like the scientific, technical rationality and other forms of like proletarian thinking in the book. I don't remember exactly what your conclusions were, but for example, going back to COVID, like I had tried my best to have my own theory about what it was. And for a while I was leaning towards lab leak. And then some people in our Discord was like, no, you have to listen to these scientists on this podcast explain that it actually did. The conventional narrative about the pangolin is actually true. And they'll walk you through the evidence. And I listened to that and was like, okay, yeah, you're probably right. And then recently China came out with this report that's like, no, it actually comes from the United States.
Or Dietrich. Yeah, yeah.
And, right. And the what they put out in that paper, you know, it spoke to a lot of experiences I had of knowing and hearing about people getting really sick in 2019.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people were blaming it on weed vapes. They're saying
vaping. Yeah.
That's right.
Vaping disease.
They're saying these people had to go to the ICU because they were vaping B12 and weed. And then that just went away. And so was China right? Did the US invent, was it a US lab leak that went to China? But I can't know. So it, without really being able to know which narrative is true, because I'm not a scientist, you know, I can't fully trust any one source. I'm sort of in the same position as everyone else. And so what I do is if there's a COVID spike and I hear about it somewhere or just sense it because I hear about people getting sick, or if I'm riding the subway and I see working class people wearing masks, I'll wear a mask too, because I think the collective intelligence of the working class, who are the people who are on the front lines of COVID infection, are maybe not the... Maybe that's not the most scientific, most objective metric, but it's, you know, it's, I think it's a good one. And I think that's kind of what we look to. It's like, even if the working class is not, you know, in full self-conscious, self-abolitioning struggle, we kind of look to them as being intelligent in their own way, and in a way that's different from us who read and record and remember.
I think, Andy, you bring up like something that's really centrally important, and something that I think an interesting split you bring up that C.L.R. James talks about in the 1940s. Like the party is about the knowledge, it's about knowing, but the proletariat is about being, right?
Yeah,
I think we're still sort of stuck with this, even though there's no party anymore. We still have this conception of like the communist theorist as having like as at least being like the sinews of knowledge, you know, that allow the proletariat to be, or that their being is like our subject.
Right. And that there's knowing within that being.
And there's knowing within that being. And then we can tap into that thing. Cause I think that like to give Andy's theory credit, and I think it ties in with a lot of what Jasper writes in his book. I think that like the death of science, like a post-truth moment, I think what we saw over the last 10 years, let's call it, since the rise of populism, quote unquote, right, with the various different hysterias and media narratives that have been kind of drilled into our heads from both sides. And I don't mean just to say MSNBC. I'm, of course, talking about Newsmax as well, right? In this hyper-partisan moment, we're all adrift. You know, none of us can really trust news, whether it's about the lab leak or whether it's from the pangolins, whether it's like the George Floyd uprising is simply the Democrats getting at Trump, or like it's some fucking like anarchist provocateurs like leading these nice black kids into like their certain destruction for nefarious reasons or whatever. There is like a real dearth right now in like, I hate to say objective, but like fact-based understandings of the world. And I feel like we can mourn this, and perhaps we should, but should we have outsourced this to the ruling class, to the capitalist parties and to the capitalist media to begin with? Like, we should see this also as an opportunity, which as the media's legitimacy has collapsed, and not merely like for bad reasons, but for good reasons as well. This is a time to take that being called wisdom of the crowds, or like that common sense knowledge of the proletariat, and be able to wield that with some effect, because there are facts there and there is truth there. It's just truth that nobody in power is particularly interested in, because it goes against their narrative and also gives people way too much credit for knowing things. Anyways, I think that actually backs up Jasper's arguments in this book.
Yeah, I agree.
So what's next for you, Jasper? You gonna do some more book tour dates? What's
can people? Are you coming to New York?
Get the book signed soon.
Yeah, I wanna come to New York in the fall, since you know I think summer's not always a great time to come. So fall, I'm gonna arrange nice. Something. I'm gonna arrange something for the fall, and yeah. I'll definitely let you guys know. It's been a long time since I've been to New York since I think the first year of the pandemic,
it's kind of measurably shittier, so prepare yourself for that. But people,
that's true of Oakland too.
Okay, good. So people can anticipate a visit for you out here in the fall, but in the meantime you're going to keep writing articles for Brooklyn Rail and Ill Will and all that stuff.
That's right.
All right.
I'm also going up to Red May at the end of the month.
Oh great. Red May is upon us.
Yeah, they're going to do it in person for the first time since the pandemic.
Hell yeah.
Idris is going to come up and nice. Present with me. Hopefully we'll be able to have a discussion about the George Floyd uprising. His book will be out, I guess, in the fall.
5-year anniversary.
Yeah, it is. It's the 5-year anniversary, so that is the idea. Kind of crazy.
5 years since anything has happened.
Except much. That everything has happened in the last 5 years, but also nothing
in the U.S. Right, but it yeah. looks a little different elsewhere in the world. But
we're going through a revolution, guys, a bloodless revolution, a MAGA and a MAHA revolution. Sorry,
what are you looking at like elsewhere in the world? Like, you know, when we're talking about keeping our pulse on class struggle, what are some things that you're looking towards today or following today?
Well, France has had some interesting stuff happen in the last 5 years that really resembles the kind of movements that we were seeing before 2020. That's the most prominent example in my mind. I mean, it has been a largely quiet moment.
Serbia has been a little interesting, and there's been some
Serbia, that's true. Serbia, Turkey,
yeah.
Right. I don't actually know that much about Serbia. I hear that Rona is working on an article. She's been there and learning about it. So
nice.
I'm looking forward to learning about it from her.
Hell yeah.
All right. You want to call it there?
Sure.
All right. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting us
to your home.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you. I was just like so tired, so worn out for the last 3 days and the whole.
Sorry for your loss, man. I'm sorry so much. It's devastating, but it sounds like he touched a lot of lives. So,
and he was just really tough and strong. You know, I know that if the tables were turned, he would have just gone and done his events. And you know, that's what we're here for. You know, it's important to talk. You know, to go on Antifada and talk about your book, and he really understood that, you know. We published things together, and it was like he knew you can't just print a book. You have to get out there and tell people about it.
Well, we'll keep his memory alive. You'll keep his memory alive. And rest in peace, Josh Clover.
Yep. Yeah.